Hello, and welcome to recording number 31 of Gary Gygax's Saga of Old City, an annotated reading. Today is July 11th, 2021. All right, I'm going to restart here on page 237, paragraph 2. Although Everly's capture and the subsequent ransom demand from Boss Daly were not great matters as far as statecraft went, King Archibald desired intelligence on what followed these events, for he suspected that his vassal, Count Dunstan of Blamu, was overweening an ambition. The question was, would the Count send forth to Stoink the ransom required for his daughter's return? The sum being demanded was so great as to pauperize the Count, or so it was thought, and it was well known that he was no doting parent. If the ransom was not paid, Archibald's reasoning went, then the King's suspicions about Dunstan would be allayed. This would mean that he did not have the resources to bring about his daughter's release, or else he did not possess the desire to see her freed. In either event, this was not the sort of behavior that would engender respect for the Count from other heads of state, and such respect was a necessary component of any plan the Count might have to assert the sovereignty of his small domain. But if the ransom was handed over to Boss Daly, the King would do well to heed the warnings he had received about the Count's hubris. Then you came along and spoiled things, Geller said, as they came to the vessel moored beside the riverbank. Let us get aboard this ferry, and I'll continue my tale. Yes, yes, Orr urged Gord, now caught up in the story, and left in surprise as how he had intervened in the plots and machinations of crowned heads. Break. So I went back a little bit just to tie these two paragraphs together here, where King Archibald... All right, I'm on page 237, and I'm just commenting about paragraphs 2, 3, 4, and 5, where we're talking about the ransom, the monetary value of gold within Gygax's campaign, Greyhawk campaign. Now, you know, as I was mentioning about the monetary value, gold is worth a great deal more. There's several different times of coinage that we do not see in regular AD&D. I generally like it. I like the fact that the lowest value coin is the iron drab, then you have brass and bronze, then you get to copper. And then we get back to the normal, copper on up that we get for the normal value, normal metal coinage. They don't talk about coins within that metallic like gold or platinum, silver or electrum being, of different sizes, or in the past they would score the coins so that you could snap them into quarter sections where we get the idea of a quarter. And here, we have a comment that it stretches out the economy and makes gold much more important. And that, that is a major thing. And then what's also noted is that gems are particularly valuable. So if you're doing the regular thing with adventurers where they've discovered a large amount of coin, that's very difficult to drag around with you. So... the general idea would be then to change a lot of your coin over to gems that you could safely carry around with you. But it is part of this whole thing with the economy. The lower level of the economy, I think the more interesting it gets. And there is a big dividing line between those who are poor and those who are like, say, middle to upper class, and those who are truly rich, because just a few, like just one gold coin, is really enough for a person for 6 months or more to live on reasonably comfortably. But when you get to the aristocrats, they're spending 10 gold coins, 20 gold coins every month just to keep things, keep up their standard of living. And so we really have this dividing line between, say, somebody who is a craftsman, somebody who's a professor in the universities, and then the people who are the real aristocrats. And it does shape the setting in that respect. All right, and then here we have, you know, as part of the story, that Gord has caught up disturbed the plots and reasonings going on here between Archibald and the kidnapping of Evelie and the indications. So all the things that Geller, who's a spy for Archibald, was looking to find out has all been disrupted by Gord's actions of rescuing Evelie, the daughter of Dunstan. Now, the final point here is there's mention of outside of Castle Blenheim, which in this book is near Nirl. And if we look at Anna Meyer's map, the Castle Blenheim is very far off from Nirl. But here it's right by it. And then right by that, to the west, is a ferry that goes over the river there. That is, you know, I don't think that's really shown on the Anna Meyer map. And definitely the Darlene map does not show the detail very much. And, you know, here we have Nirl. That Nirl up in the Bone March is, that area is overwhelmed by monsters when Spine Castle was taken. And from this book, we also learned that Johnsport was also taken. And obviously, I think part of the Bone March to begin with, now retaken by, in this book, by Radic and the Radicans. So it is, we have to look that originally Dunstan and Blamu is under the protection and service to Nyrond. I'm reading here that from Anna's map, there were a lot of cues about this area for, for the area around Nirl and Castle Blenheim. And it seems to be some distances seem to be off, and some of the actual points seem to be looking at it backwards. Right. And yeah, that's the Harp River. And there's a point on this map that shows a town to the west that actually should be, I think that should be Owlsthorpe. It's a town called, I can't remember, Glendsheven. I can't read it off the map.
Yeah, something like that. I'll find it.
Yeah, and it's just Nirl probably shouldn't be in the crook of that river so tightly. Maybe a little further east on that little dot. Glendeven, yes. And that's supposed to be Nyrond.
Yep,
There's another town across the river. But in Gord's book, it talks about them coming to a shallows in the Harp River, which would be east up by what is Glendeven, and crossing that and then heading south. And then when they're going south, there's this small town called Feltenham or...
Fassel Farm.
And Fassel Farm should be west of Nirl, but across the Harp River on the east. And then you go east from there, because they say they're going left and they're headed south. So that would mean they're heading east, and then they come up to Castle Blenheim in Nirl. And, the way that the fans map is, it's kind of reversed. There's a couple things that are reversed right there. So now the other thing is that some of the references are unique to the Gordon, the Saga of Old City novel. So they're not even references that are coming from, say, an interpretation from second edition. They're just, I think that the directions that you're reading sometimes get a little confusing. And so they had them approaching from the south up toward Nirl, when really they crossed the river to the north and they were traveling south down to Nirl. So, but it's just little pieces like that. It's not terribly important to the story, but it's this minutia that I particularly enjoy, filling out the the Greyhawk map and lore that I particularly like trying to follow here and pick out of this book. All right. Now they've just crossed the ferry. I'm going to restart here. It is page number 237, and it is the second paragraph from the end. The problem was, everyone was watching for a company of the Count's men escorting the gold for his daughter's ransom, Geller resumed, skirting the issue of how Gord disrupted any scheme but that of Boss Daly. Gord urged him to get on to that point. Geller simply smiled and continued the line of discourse he had begun. He explained how the boss of Stoink, several other interested parties of that ilk, Geller himself, and even Evely, had spies watching for ransom carriers from Blamu. The captive girl, it seemed, had used her charm, and possibly a bit of her magic, to suborn at least two of Lord Daly's hirelings or servants. For the sake of both her peace of mind and her physical safety, she more than anyone else wished to know news of her impending rescue. Break. Now, going back back when Evely was captured, she has a lady's maid there with her in the Lord Mayor's palace, Boss Daly's in Stoink, and it had seemed to me, there was never directly said, but it seemed to me that the lady's maid was not like a spy on Evely, but was actually knew that Evely was expecting to, escape and go and had plans of getting out of there and perhaps was going to help her herself. One of the things that Gygax does is a lot of times there'll be something subtle like that, or even more questions how this and such happened. And then later on, a few pages later, he'll do a reveal where he'll say, well, you know, this happened because of this action, but you didn't know what the action was at the time. There was one part where there was a mercenary recruiting, and Gord and Geller pretended to be leaders of bands of bandits and a company of men, and they were going to pretend to join. And Gord slipped a Mickey, some drug, to make the merchant, the mercenary leader, pass out. And it's not mentioned. That's why the mercenary leader at that point in the story passes out. It's only later that you think, that you realize that there was this, drug that Gord had slipped him.
Yeah, and Geller says that he caught him, he saw him do it or something.
That's right. So later on, you know, this happens. The mercenary leader passes out, and you don't know if he was just too drunk, but it seemed very strange. And even that is commented on in the story by his lieutenant, that he didn't ever see the mercenary leader get so drunk before to pass out. And so later on, Gygax reveals what Gord had been doing. And so again, like this little point here is just a small point, but again, it seems like, it's not named, but it seemed like from the story that the lady's maid was suborned and serving Evely at the end.
I think her name was Goldie.
I'm afraid I can't remember offhand.
I'm not 100% either.
Yeah, we're back several recordings at that point. There's been a lot of things happening between the escape and now at the point we are. It is one great thing about this book is that there is so much information in it. My primary goals are lore and then things relating to the AD&D game and role-playing, and finally the actual story itself. All right, I'm going to restart right here. It is page number 238, second paragraph. By the time Gord had appeared on the scene, her hopes were at their lowest ebb, for time would be up soon, and there had been no news of any force of Count Lemoo's, or even one in his employ heading for Stoink. Had there been, Evelie, of course, would have never risked her life and limb in a perilous escape attempt, formulated or unformulated, as was more accurately the case, by a young thief of uncertain origin and questionable motives. Gord had to grin at the last statement. Right. Now, the story so far has had Gord very, very good at planning, very good at coming up with things on the fly, and it was very strange that Gord, when he went to rescue Evelie, he had a good plan for getting in. He had a fake pass made up. He knew who the commander was and the things about the commander that helped him reach Evelie where she was kept. But as soon as he gets her out, he then seems to have no plan of escape whatsoever. And as the story's told, they escape just by, you know, fortuitous coincidence rather than any plan of Gord's. And that was very strange. It was a very strange part of the story because Gord is normally a planner. And here, the escaped is really just was luck. You know, he escaped by pure luck. And then, now, jumping back to this point about the ferry and Fazzle Farm, they're saying that the ride to Nurl from the ferry takes half a day. And then there is there's Fazzle Farm. And then from Fazzle Farm, it is east over to Nurl. And so, you know, if you're looking at the map and not using you know, any other sources, then it seems like there is some kind of miscommunication there on the fan map. That they put Fazzle Farm on the west bank of the Harp River, and that they have it southeast of Nurl when it really should be west of Nurl, and on the east side of the Harp River.
All right.
Okay, I'm going to restart here, and it is page number 238, paragraph 3. "Off this scow now, lad," said Geller, as the ferry was moored on the opposite bank. "Now we ride cross-country for the Flinties and the burrows of gnome kind." "Flinties? Gnomes? What is this talk, Geller?" "Are you tire of my story already?" said Geller with a shy, sly grin. "Are you subtly more interested in what we must do next, ere we are free to pursue a more independent course?" "Oh, no, good sir," said Gord, a hint of friendly sarcasm in his tone. "Past for now, the future for later." So Geller picked up his original tale as their steeds trotted westward. Break. Now, I'm stopping right here because this is something within the story that I've always found a little bit rough, is that Gygax tended to use, especially in swearing or talk, a early 20th century vernacular that wouldn't be, you know, more like 20s gangster talk. And here, he seems to have slipped into, not just here, but even, you know, back since he's been, had Gord imprisoned, that Gord is now, and the other characters seem to be talking in a fantasy medieval talk. So, you know, he used a lot of 20th century vulgarity and a lot of 20th century terms in the story before, especially in the dialogue. So it is a little strange that he seems to have slipped now into this fantasy medieval. And I'm not sure if there may have been a pause in writing of the book where maybe that he's changed some ideas, because that does happen where you know, there can be great pauses. I remember there's a comment where Tolkien comment on where when he reached a certain point in, I believe it was The Hobbit, where it took him months to get further. When he was reviewing and rewriting the earlier part, it took him months to get back toward a certain part of the story and take it up again. And by that time, a lot of viewpoints are changed for a writer. So I'm maybe right here, that's what's happening. Now, we also have a comment about the Flinties and the gnome kind. I'm not sure exactly why the Flinties should be throwing Gord off right here. And Eve also that there are gnomes there, because I was pretty certain that Gord knew and had heard that this area, was the yeah, and that the Flinty Hill gnomes are very well known, and they've been a big, they have to be a big enough community, because it is mentioned here, well, earlier, that they are ones helping to retake sections of the Bone March against the monsters. So yeah, not only...
He and Eva Lee saw gnomes on their way through the Flinties.
Yeah, so I'm not quite sure what is surprising Gord at this point. But, you know, I'll go on right here. All right, I am going to restart. It is page 238, and paragraph... paragraph 5. "Oh, no, good sir," said Gord, a hint of friendly sarcasm in his tone. "Past for now, the future for later." So Geller picked up his original tale as their steeds trotted westward. "Dunstan is a most clever chap," Geller began. "Not as wily as he deems himself by any stretch of the mind, but clever enough to outwit all those watching for his train bearing a virtual king's ransom in orbs. The boss was eager to receive the train, of course, and Evelie was anxious to learn it was coming so she could be free. But most of those on the lookout for the caravan desired only to loot it. To thwart this last group of road watchers, the Count of Blamoo made arrangements and sent messengers accordingly, so that the sum was gathered within the walls of Stoink itself." "How could that be?" demanded the wondering listener. "Oh, it isn't a new idea. Only one which is most uncommon and rarely used," Geller replied, nodding contemplatively. "Sums are borrowed and lent between certain dealers in jewels, money changers, bankers, and the like. They have devised a means to transfer large amounts by means of written notes. Naturally, these notes are carefully done and heavily magicked, but once executed are as good as gold." This amazed the young thief, for he had imagined that he knew just about all there was to know about wealth. Geller then explained to him that such instruments had a way of taking on a sort of mystical value themselves, becoming as dear as, or even dearer than, the physical things they represented, be they precious metals, gems, silk, spices, or something else. Break. Well, that's interesting. I'm not sure if I've read of paper currency in the Greyhawk setting. Now, this general idea is taken from Ivanhoe, where it is one of the central themes that Richard I has been taken prisoner, and they're trying to raise a ransom for him, but instead his brother John is just taking the money. But they're trying to raise a ransom, and there are money lenders, and they are taking the idea that a note passed from a money lender in England can be sent over to a money lender in, I believe, Austria, where Richard is being held without any coin or risk, especially because it's not magic, but the moneylenders know each other and are usually part of the same family, or at least cultural group. And so they send these coded messages back and forth, and so that they're using a kind of paper currency, a promissory note. Now, currency, actually, paper currency, I believe, goes back to China, and they used it there first, a long while before Richard I. But in popular, Western literature, I think the earliest mention is in the Ivanhoe books about, using that kind of thing. And I assume that Gygax was aware both of the historical and, literary references, to somebody being kidnapped and paid off with a promissory note, and it exchanged and saving that problem of transporting the loot. But here also is a little aside about, that paper currency develops its own mystical value. All right. I am going to restart. It is page number 239 and paragraph 2. On the very day and night that Gord had planned and executed his brash rescue of the lady in Durance Vile, an agent of her father's sending was in Stoink, carrying with him a document calling for transfer of metal equivalent to 10,000 gold orbs from certain persons in the town of the Lord Mayor. The sum was so vast an amount that it took 2 days to gather. Had you acted but one day later, Geller pointed out to Gord, you would have found the Lady Evely gone, bound for her homeland under a heavily armed guard furnished by her former captain, Boss Daly. If anything, a ransomer must be true to his word, or he shall have but a single go at kidnap and payment. So the boss planned to see the girl delivered to the Count's protection with care and safety. At that, Gord had to laugh bitterly. Some hero he had turned out to be. Evely's journey home would have been faster, easier, and much safer if he had not invaded the Lord Mayor's castle. And more to the point, he would never have laid eyes on the walls of the Count's dungeon. Geller agreed, in response to a wry observation from Gord, that things were not always as they seemed. The news, he went on, was soon buzzing through the bandit capital of Gord's taking of the girl from under the boss's nose. Break. There's this little comment here that from Geller, that things were not always, from Gord, that things were not always as they seemed. That is a big theme within this story. Now, Saga of Old City featuring Gord is told from a thief's point of view. And here, we definitely have this idea that much of what happens is not direct action. There's usually some kind of subterfuge and disguise, and either big plans for it or else very quick things that are done by the seat of their pants. And that is a running theme in the action of this story, is that things are not as they seem. All right. I'm going to restart. It is page number 239, final paragraph. "He was furious," said Geller, "both at the insult and the loss of fortune. No amount of searching turned you up, and several powerful spellcasters were required to finally track down your means of escape. But the same magic users were then unable to locate you anywhere, and they claimed that powerful Deomers were protected you too. There was no ransom paid, of course, for word of Evely's disappearance reached those gathering the gold, and they quickly returned their thousands to vault and strongroom forthwith. That saved Dunstan his coin. The fact he had agreed to pay alerted me that something was most certainly amiss. There are means of communication that allow near instantaneous transmission of speech, but these magical communications must be most secret and protected from the many who would overhear or intercept. It required several days, but eventually I managed to pass on the intelligence, and then I came after you too. Break. Now, I'm wondering what spells allow instant communication at a distance. I mean, I think there's some scrying devices that might do it, but offhand in first edition AD&D, I'm just not coming up with what magic spells or items allow, long distance communication. Now it's been pointed out here too that we don't want to sound critical of Anna's maps here. It's just I love finding little discrepancies, and a lot of things here that it really depends. I'm not all that familiar with a lot of second edition and even third edition references, so that going through what's first edition off of, the Darling maps and the very, bare bones stuff from the Folio and 83 box set, that there really isn't much detail. Not to this level where we're talking about small towns and ferries and fords and such. But Gord's novels add about 2,500 pages of story and details. And, I know for myself, having done a large amount of work indexing the Greyhawk material, that, there are plenty of small errors that creep into your work. And things need to be revised over and over and have a second eye on them. And these are really minuscule, tiny little minutiae here. That we're working, talking about.
Yeah, we probably never would have found them if we weren't poring them over the way we are.
Yeah, I mean, I have read these books 7 times. especially Saga of Old City, I've read it at least 7 times before. And there is so much that we are pulling out and noticing, like the fact that Blamu is obviously an anagram of Bloom, having Jonsport also taken over as well as Spinecastle. I never realized that before. And these town locations, especially because they're mostly just a few lines about these villages or small towns that are thrown into this book. And so, reading it through, unless you're looking for this heavy detail, it just goes by. I mean, it's gone by for me, where I've never noticed it before.
Yeah, it's really, really fun getting to look at it in this depth.
Yeah, and here we have a comment that the John of Jonsport is a reference to Frank Metzner's Aquaria Founders. And, that is, again, something that I've never noticed myself. I've never made note of that. So here, Jonsport is... very far. It's on the eastern coast of what was once the Bone March and then was taken by monsters and then retaken by Radikers. And, that Jonsport is a very, very interesting place, having been conquered and then reconquered and now brought back into more civilized hands. A very interesting city. The way that Spinecastle, as a conquered city, taken over by monsters is again, a place of a lot of adventure. One of the things to consider is that in the story, and I think it throws some readers off, is that the places that are peaceful and that they're, have a better, they're more just, they're more peaceful, those are more boring to adventure in than places like Stoink or Spinecastle, which are rife with adventure. All right. sorry, I am going to restart. It is page number 240, paragraph 2. At this point, the two riders came to a lane leading northwest. Geller steered his mount onto the path, saying, "Now I think it best to give my throat a rest until we partake of some refreshment." Ford followed his lead, of course, and the pair rode in silence. After a short time, they arrived in a rustic little hamlet. There they supped at a local tavern, while their mounts were fed and watered. An hour later, the pair cantered on, still following the dirt road as it wound its way toward the first great tours of the Flinty Hills. All right, break. Now, here we have a little hamlet, unnamed. So it doesn't get really, you know, for myself, I never would have referenced it as a unnamed little hamlet. But here we can make note that if you are, you know, filling out this area, that west of the ford that leads, west of the ferry that leads to Nurl and Casu Blemu is a little unnamed hamlet ready for you to add your own touch to, develop a name. Because there's nothing in there but a little throwaway comment about an unnamed hamlet and an inn where Geller and Gord stop on their way to the Flinty Hills. And, you know, here is a comment about Geller being a bard and really, you know, a good example of, you know, a iconic example of a bard. Now, at this point, I kind of remember that from previous readings, but at this point, there's been no mention of him being a bard, just him being a spy and a thief, and pretending to be a Lord General.
Yeah, I remember him being a bard, too, but I don't remember a reference in the book up till this point about it.
Yeah, no, I'm sure there's been no reference, just because this is the big reveal for Geller, is when he has come to Nurl and Castle Blemu and rescued Gord. I did find that a little timely, you know, that he comes on Gord just as about Gord's going to make his escape. And I personally would have, I would have preferred like him encountering Gord after he'd already brained the warden or done something, you know, maybe irrevocable, or finding Gord still in the cells. I found it threw me off a little to have that bit of serendipity there where Geller gets there exactly as Gord is about to whack his manacles into the head of the warden. But, yeah. You know.
I was kind of surprised Gord didn't say what took you so long or something.
I know. I mean, I did find it reasonable then that Gord was so upset that he didn't act like himself, that he was angry. He didn't do his usual reading of the situation and acting in the best way to just get himself out of trouble. But instead, he was so angry that he was going to make matters worse until Geller hushed him.
Right. For a while, he was despondent. You know, he couldn't believe that she didn't love him the way he loved her.
Yes.
And then he got mad.
Yeah. And he was not his normal self right there. And that actually, I think, was a little bit better writing than having Geller show up, you know, just in time. You know, I found that business unlikely. And so to me, you know, it was more cartoonish for Geller to arrive there. But, you know, he wanted that. He always tries to inject a little bit of humor in things, like when Gordon Evely are escaping, and Evely is checking for traps for an exit, and right behind her back, a monster swells up, and Gord kills it, and she never even notices. So okay. There's, yeah.
The rag monster, the ragworm.
The ragworm, yeah, yeah. We got to write that up.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Just like I remember that Geller is a bard. I think we had a question 2 days ago about Gord's lineage.
Yes.
I remember that too, but I don't want to say just yet.
Yeah, and the question was that he seems, it's been noted in what we've read that Gord has the skin color and features of a René. And so, you know, there's questions, and he was adopted by the René during his escape from the city of Greyhawk. So it's, you know, is Gord have a René background? Because we don't know. Nope. And at that point, you know, it's just left open where the story goes.
Yep, you have to keep coming back.
Yeah. Great. I'm going to continue here. It is page number 240. Paragraph 3. Geller had not desired to resume his narrative during their meal, because the tale was for Gord's ears alone. Once out of the hamlet, however, he further dealt with his tracing of Evelyn and her rescuer. It had not been difficult to determine the dailies, determine the goal that was set, but the exact route was the question. Ross Daly's minions had searched far and wide, they missed by days locating the fleeing couple. Geller had picked up the trail in Midmeadow, using the activity of agents of the bandit lord to put him on the scent, as it were. There was a delay, for he had to eliminate several of these odious fellows, including the assassin who led them. This forced Geller to spend further time avoiding those who would track him down, for daring to handle so roughly the servants of Stoink, and by the time all that blew over, and Boss Daly called the whole thing off, more than a week had passed. There was difficulty finding where Gord and Lady Evelyn had gone from Wamtham, and Geller had ridden all the way to Inspa before eventually discovering that the two had not journeyed all that distance with the pilgrims. Between such delays as those he had recounted, and pauses for passing various sorts of information to one group or another, Geller said ruefully that nearly a month was frittered away before he caught up with the trail once again. Break. All right, and just a little campaign information here that we have, that Wamtham, and then is a distance from Inspa, and that it is journeyed by pilgrims. That the journey by pilgrims is probably the most significant thing right there. So you can add that to your lore information. And also, if you're trying to run a campaign, it's a general idea. And then you have to ask why are people going to why are pilgrims? What is it in Inspa that is attracting these pilgrims? We also have the mention of an assassin. Now, more than likely, what Gygax means is a AD&D character class assassin, rather than just somebody who is working as assassin, who might be a thief or a warrior or even a mage or a cleric. The assassin is a particular class, and I just think from the context that we have a professional assassin leading that little band, and then mention that Gord is, Gord is able to remove him and his band. Speaks a lot about, Geller's relative strength and abilities. We also have here that Geller really is showing, a lot of himself here by being able to track Gord. And then, rediscover the trail back heading toward Castle Blemmu. All right, I'm going to restart right here. It is page number 240, the final paragraph. The hillmen were quite impressed by Gord's fighting ability. He said parenthetically, "These wild and independent folk thought bravery and self-defense to be paramount virtues." In any event, Geller went on, it was no task at all to determine thereafter that Gord and Evelyn had managed to get her to her father's fief without further mishap. However, careful inquiries in Nurl brought no mention of Gord's name. All that was known was that the Count's daughter had mysteriously reappeared at Castle Blemmu. Finding what had become of Gord was important to him, but Geller had to state flatly that there were more important matters to clear up first. Dunstan had been sending a stream of communications to Lexnall, his valorous prominence of Radic. These related to a proposed alliance between the Baron and the Count, and were to be sealed by nuptials between Baron Radic's son, Alain, destined to become the fourth Baron Radic bearing that name, and the Count's fair daughter. At this point, Gord grew grim and interjected an oath, but Geller calmed him sufficiently to continue relating the story before long. He helped the young thief to understand that politics and ambition were the moving forces behind what had transpired. Radic is a backward place, but not so isolated as not to have its own spies and informants. Baron questioned the Count as to the matter of Evelie's kidnap, and returned delicately inquiring as to her virginity. In this matter a lie will not do, and so it came to pass that the Count had to dower his daughter with much gold for the marriage contract to be completed and the secret alliance forged. Break. Now, it is commented before that one of the things that Archibald is worried about is the ambitions of Dunstan. And so here are several things which Geller notes, that right away that instead of not ransoming his daughter, he actually did, but in a more secret way. And so that would put the fears of Archibald up, because if he had the wherewithal to afford that king's ransom, that showed resources to go with Dunstan's ambitions. And here we find now that Lexnall, the Baron of Radic, that he is forging a secret alliance and marriage, to the Blemus, and that again would be a major consideration in how Nyrond and King Archibald is going to deal with his, vassal, and the likelihood of Dunstan breaking away is even greater now. Now we have, the son of the Baron, mentioned as Alain, and then we have a mention here that that Radic is a backward place. So, but still maintains its own spies. And that, again, is becoming a real theme now that we've heard in the upper levels. Part of a campaign you can run is all this spying. There are spies from Stoink, there are spies from Nyrond, there are spies from Count Blamu, and now there's spies from Radic. And I would assume that you would have a very much like little James Bond possible game here, with all this spying that is going on. I would imagine that every state has its own spies and its own subterfuge. If we look back a little bit, the Horn Society was trying to incite the bandit kingdoms to go up against the Tenna and the Pale, who had conquered some of the bandit kingdoms, while ignoring what the Horn Society was doing, since they had also conquered some bandit kingdoms in the West. So we have this this higher level type of spy campaign. And also, we also have Gygax having a warfare campaign where, there's in Stoink is a center for hiring mercenaries and bandit groups and monstrous tribes. They're all around Stoink where you can hire them, and there's warfare going on. And warfare talked about going on to either take back the bandit kingdoms or fight against the Pale and the Tenna host, and even the Hierarchs, the Horn Society troops. So right here we have an idea of about a thief campaign and a spying campaign and also a warfare campaign. Not as all-encompassing and game-changing and nation-changing as later was done in the setting work, but on a smaller scale where we have these bandit kingdoms as maybe a good introduction to playing a mercenary campaign or a warfare campaign. And so, you know, radically different from the dungeon idea of, you know, the original AD and then the wilderness idea of adventuring here and the city adventuring that was shown in City of Greyhawk. Here we've moved up to spying, mercenary groups, and warfare. All right. Now I'm going to restart. And it is page 241, and the second paragraph from the end. In the course of discovering all this, Geller had also found out that there was a nameless prisoner in the dungeon of Castle Glemmu. With this knowledge, Geller assumed the identity of General Nalbon of the House of Geller, and Gord knew the rest. The alliance between the Radican ruling dynasty and Dunstan was not in itself undesirable. The King of Nyrond was indeed pleased to have one of his vassals related to a potentially active enemy of Erdi, so long as that vassal was still loyal to Archibald III. The realm stretching from Relmor Bay to Solnor Ocean, bounded by the Teaser Torrent, titillates the ambitions of his august supremacy, said Geller. When I send word of all I have learned to Rel Mord, it is a good bet that Castle Blemmu shall have royal visitors soon, and thereafter certain fortresses containing the king's own soldiers shall be constructed at the expense of the count, and their upkeep assisted by the loyal Dunstan. Indeed, that is a tale for which I thank you, my friend, Gord said. So my dear Evely is to become the Palatine Baroness of Radic, and dwell amidst the chill and barbarous wilds of that place, while I roam freely through the warmer climes, and free to love whomever I please. As the revelation came over him, Gord had to laugh. Geller joined in with fellow feeling. Yes, indeed, Geller said brightly, and her visit south to her father's country shall be from a sovereign state to a part of the kingdom of Nyrond, not a jaunt through a new realm composed of Radic, Bone March, and Blemu's fair hills and dells. Where now? Asked Gord, his mood considerably brighter than it had been a couple of minutes ago. Break. Well, you know, here we show where the plot's going and some ideas about the politics. Now, this business of constructing castles and fortresses at the expense of Dunstan, you know, the Count Blemmu, that reminds me of the construction of the castles that went along the border of Wales. At one point in history, there were a number of castles put up that served, you know, two purposes. Is one was to see over the rebellious Welsh, but the other was to keep border kings, the border lords, from having too much wealth and power. So in the past, on our earth, the royals would come and visit various lords and their estates and therefore drain their resources. And so the construction of these castles in our past in England was, you know, twofold, as it would be twofold here. One in here is to protect the Bone March and the wildlands taken over by the monsters, but the other to drain resources of Camp Blamu, which him having the money now unspent to ransom his daughter, and 10,000 gold in this setting goes quite a long way. Now we have the idea that Archibald's going to drain all that by, you know, having the count pay for the troops, and so it's and pay for the construction of castles, and so that is a historical thing that actually worked, and you could see it happening here, in the Bone March area where the Count Blamu has been expanding and increasing the size of his holdings. All right, we're getting close to the end here. I'll pick up a little bit here. It's page number 242, and it is paragraph 5. to the Gnome King of these hills, and then what say you to a visit to Ralmord? From there, who knows? Perhaps south to Almor, or back to the Bandit Kingdoms. I have never traveled to Nyron's great capital, Gord replied with enthusiasm. It sounds like a good place to see. And then I'm ready for any new place in this broad land. As they made camp for the night, Gord spoke to his friend. You're older and wiser than I, Geller. Tell me how Evely could put aside loves such as we shared for a liaison to a petty northern barony, albeit an independent realm. Gord, my young friend, you are not being either realistic or fair. Would you have loved your little part-elven lass half so much had she not been so fair of face and form? Gord was allowed to ponder, a moment to ponder that. Then Geller expanded upon the thought. Did you pledge her true and faithful love forever? Or was it ardor and amour? What bright future did you paint? How would your children have been cared for? Children, future, what talk is that? Responded Gord. We had passion and adventure, romance and excitement. That is the stuff of dalliance and brief affairs, my lad, not a basis for an enduring relationship. Think on it. Evely is young and beautiful, but female. She, as do all of her sex, seeks security, stability, sons and daughters. You, as a male, desire to spread your offspring far and wide. The more, the merrier. Thus you gain a measure of immortality, for some will be certain to survive and carry on your line. In contrast, Evely is aware that her own heritage must be limited to those children she bears herself. They must be cared for, nourished in mind and body, so that they thrive and grow to adulthood. That is how women gain their continuance, and it is quite the opposite of males. Break.
I bet the Gizmodo guy loves this part.
I know. That is, but you know, I mean, that is, it's not just an attitude of someone from the 20th century. That is a reflection of what the historical attitudes were. And I know that instead we should have, you know, the girl hero, as you know, what they, that is more popular today, but it's still, it's not unexpected that in a fantasy novel that's would be. If we get back to Ivanhoe, you know, I mean, that is a story from, I believe, the, when was that written? The 19th century or the 18th century. I don't remember offhand. But it is a thing where that is exactly the kind of attitude we have in Ivanhoe.
1819 it was published.
All right, so it's early 19th century. It's a wonderful story, but again, it would be deeply insulting if somebody wanted everything to be modern. And I will say, in a fantasy story, it's not necessary to put women in the same role as they would be in a historical novel. In a historical novel, it's best to try to keep the, unless you're doing a fantasy historic where you're changing things, it's best to try to keep with the history of the times and the attitudes of the times. But in the fantasy novel, really, with the idea that individuals, rather than commanding power, have the power within themselves, like clerics and magic users and skilled thieves and fighters and assassins, that they are individually much more powerful than, you know, a commoner or somebody inexperienced. And that, you know, it allows them to be fantasy heroic. Even like the idea of, like, Cyrano de Bergerac, who supposedly, you know, he can fight dozens of men because he is cast in a heroic light. Whereas, you know, like Ivanhoe, he is a warrior and a strong one, but he is not cast as a superhero. He is not cast as somebody who can just, like Conan, cut his way through 100 men. In fact, you know, he is grievously wounded, you know, during a, I believe, a melee during a joust or during the joust itself. Or maybe he's even ambushed, but he is grievously wounded at one point. And, you know, so here, you didn't necessarily have to write that, you know, that women were going to be in a position where they couldn't, you know, couldn't be heroic in of themselves, except in a way that is, you know, historically similar. It's not necessary to get really worked up about it, that, you know, Gygax was using what he had read and what he had read of history, what he had seen in pop fiction. You know, this was not going to be a reversal of the accepted norms. He was writing a fantasy novel that, you know, it did have a lot of in it that was the expected norms. But down the road, you know, in other books, I will tell you that Gord encounters powerful female characters. You know, they're powerful fighters, and, you know, they in themselves are cast in the heroic mold. And Gord is showing himself to be, you know, truly inexperienced. You know, like Geller's pointing out, he's very naive at this point. And really, he was an orphan in the city of Greyhawk. It's amazing that he knows as much as he does and has experience, but he's had a very jaded upbringing from the thief, you know, the attitude of the world from a thief and an orphan, and, you know, rising from being the poorest of the poor. So, you know, there's a lot here, and I can see why somebody looking at it through how everything is cast now can see it, you know, shockingly. But I think that it is, you know, very much true to a lot of, you know, popular fiction and from, the, you know, the early 20th century and before, that this Gygax was simply being true to a lot of the sources that he had read from. And in the sense that Gord doesn't think a different way, I don't think Gygax would think a different way, you know, not being heavily exposed to the changes, that social changes that we're seeing right now.
Yeah, well, either way, I mean, it's as far as we know, that's really only Geller's opinion. We don't know that that's Gary's opinion. You know, he could just be writing a character who believes that.
Yes, and one thing to note with this story, the viewpoint is often not omniscient. We're not being told how things actually are. We're being told how Gord sees things, how Geller sees things. And it is not being said that to Geller's viewpoint, this is what Geller thought. It's being said by Geller, and through the narrative where Geller might not speak, but this is how Geller thinks. This is how Gord thinks. And so we're not seeing this viewpoint outside of the characters. We're seeing the characters' viewpoint of things, and so it's very open to interpretation.
It's a little strange because Geller's cousin is the ruler of the county of Ernst, right? And she's a woman.
Yeah, she's the Countess Belisica. Now, there's asking here, are they naming the personages in Radic? Yes, they just named Lexnal and Elaine. Lexnal is the Baron of Radic, and Elaine is his son, who's going to marry Evely and be the future, the fourth Elaine of Elic, of Radic, I'm sorry.
And Evely will be the Baroness.
Yes. Now, I had thought, and I'll have to go back and check on this, but I thought back in Stoink that Gygax referred to her as a Baroness. Yes, it is something here mentioned about that, you know, that these personages and the history, it does get very confusing. I can see when Sargent reintroduced the setting in From the Ashes, it is already apparent that he was using information that he or somebody else gathered from these Gord the Rogue novels, at least the first two, so that there might be changes, but there's information that is not found in the earlier setting material that is found in these books that was then used by Sargent. So, you know, somebody providing a basic write-up for the setting, or Sargent himself, was familiar with what was going on in these stories. So some of the things that we're seeing here, like, you know, the Lexnol and Elaine and, you know, all this information is actually used later on as lore for the you know, for the noose, the setting being, you know, pushed forward and down a timeline and taken the second edition view of things. Well, we're a little past, and I want to jump over to, it's a night for J. Lord Gazumba, and I wanted to jump over there, so I'm going to invite Craig in and our friendly neighborhood, you know, recording bot, and I am going to end things for tonight. It is July 11th, 2021. And let me just find what page I was on here. I'm afraid I closed up everything real quick. We are on page 243. All right. Good night.